Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, March 13, 2014, during a live teleform conference call. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleform conference call. Today, our topic is FSOC and Dodd-Frank. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. I also want to inform our audience that our primary guest today, Mr. Peter Wallison, is going to be speaking largely from his article, which can be found on the event page for today's call on the Federal Society's website. The title of the article is The Authority of the FSOC and the FSP to Designate SIFIs, Implications for the Regulation of Insurers in the United States After the Prudential Decision. So we're going to get opening remarks from Mr. Wallison of about 20 minutes or so. He'll be followed by Wayne Abernathy, who will ask him a few probing questions and encourage some discussion between the two of them. And then, as always, we'll be turning to the audience for your questions, so please be ready with your questions. Their bios have been provided to you in conjunction with the notice you got for the call, so I'm not going to introduce them any further. I'm simply going to turn things over to Mr. Wallison for the opening remarks. Peter Wallison, go right ahead.
Thanks a lot, Dean. In September of 2013, the Financial Stability Oversight Council, which I'll call FSOC throughout this discussion, determined that Prudential Financial, one of the country's largest insurers, was a systemically important financial institution, and I'll call those SIFIs, S-I-F-I, systemically important financial institution. Under the Dodd-Frank Act then, Prudential was turned over to the Federal Reserve for what is likely to be bank-like regulation, very stringent bank-like regulation. The paper on which this talk is based was written for an organization called Networks Financial Institute at the Indiana State University. And it reviews the FSOC's decision on Prudential and its implications for both the insurance industry and the financial services industry as a whole. The FSOC is a creation of the Dodd-Frank Act and is uniquely powerful within the executive branch. It consists of 15 members, of which 10, with one exception, are the chairs of other federal financial regulatory agencies. Five are non-voting members. The Secretary of the Treasury is the chairman and has an effective veto over any major FSOC action because the Act requires his affirmative vote. Insurance is regulated at the state level in the United States, so there is no federal agency with expertise in insurance. For this reason, the Dodd-Frank Act authorizes the president to appoint, with the consent of the Senate, one voting member of the FSOC, who is called the independent member having insurance expertise. The Prudential decision was the second decision of the FSOC involving an insurance-related firm. In July 2013, the agency designated American International Group, known as AIG, as a SIFI. That decision was expected, perhaps even politically compelled. AIG had famously been bailed out by the Treasury and the Federal Reserve during the financial crisis. The Prudential decision was the first to designate a non-bank financial institution as a SIFI when that firm had not suffered any significant financial distress during the financial crisis. Dodd-Frank enjoins the FSOC to, quote, identify risks to the financial stability of the United States that could arise from the material financial distress or failure or ongoing activities of large interconnected bank holding companies or non-bank financial firms. Obviously, Prudential is a non-bank financial firm. The decision to designate Prudential as a SIFI was made under Section 113 of the Act, which authorizes the FSOC to designate a non-bank financial firm as a SIFI if, quote, the council, that is the FSOC, determines that material financial distress at the U.S. non-bank financial company could pose a threat to the financial stability of the United States. Close quote. The first thing to be said about this language is that it is a remarkable grant of authority. Essentially, it permits the FSOC to determine the scope of its own jurisdiction. Although the courts frown on this when it is called to their attention, it is possible that this grant of authority will never be challenged. Regulated firms fearing retaliation are very reluctant to challenge the legal authority of their regulators. Thus, because the key terms of the FSOC must apply in order to take jurisdiction over any particular firm, that is, financial distress and market instability, because they have no clear meaning, and because both involve predictions about the future, they amount to an enormous grant of discretionary power to the FSOC. This discussion, my paper, draws several conclusions. The first is the FSOC's decision on Prudential was largely perfunctory. The agency did not take seriously a need to show why Prudential was actually a SIFI. This should not be a surprise because the Treasury and the Fed, the two most important agencies in the FSOC, had already approved the designation of Prudential as a SIFI by the Financial Stability Board the preceding July. Now, the Financial Stability Board I'll describe in detail later, but it's an organization of international regulators, financial ministers, and governments operating in Europe. The Financial Stability Board's decision was, if anything, more perfunctory than the FSOC's. The decision the designation of SIFIs gives regulators, both at the FSB and the FSOC, unprecedented power to control the financial system, and they will use it. The SIFI designation is not about data. It is about enhancing the power of regulators and their ability eventually to capture and control what they call shadow banking. Dodd-Frank sets out the standards that the FSOC is required to use in determining whether a non-bank financial institution is a threat to the stability of the financial system. There are close to a dozen factors mentioned in the law, but these can be broken down into several key ones: leverage, off-balance sheet exposures, the nature, scope, size, scale, concentration, interconnectedness, and mix of activities, and reliance on short-term funding. Those are the principal key elements that the Dodd-Frank wanted the FSOC to consider. Whether any or all of these apply to Prudential can only be guessed at by reading the FSOC document in which the FSOC's reasoning was detailed. This paper summarized its decision as follows. Prudential is a significant participant in financial markets and the U.S. economy, and is significantly interconnected to insurance companies and other financial firms through its products and capital markets activities. Because of Prudential's interconnectedness, size, certain characteristics of its liabilities and products, material financial distress at Prudential could lead to an impairment of financial intermediation or of market functioning that would be sufficiently severe to inflict significant damage on the broader economy. That's the end of the quote. Although this is a summary paragraph, we will see that the agency never adduced any specific evidence to back its assertions. The FSOC's discussion of how Prudential might cause financial instability in the U.S. market was organized under two key subjects called the asset liquidation channel and the exposure channel. In the liquidation channel, the FSOC argued that if policyholders chose to terminate their relationships with Prudential in sufficient numbers or seek the cash surrender value of their policies, this could cause Prudential to, quote, liquidate a substantial portion of its general account assets to meet redemption and withdrawal requests. This, in turn, could cause significant disruptions in key markets. However, the FSOC never explained what a substantial portion of Prudential's assets actually was, how many insurers would have to withdraw their funds, or what actual effect that might have on the markets. The FSOC scenario might have been plausible if it had data to show that Prudential relied on leverage and short-term funding. In that case, a sharp change in the availability of short-term credit could cause a lack of confidence in Prudential that might lead to fund withdrawals. But the FSOC apparently didn't have such data. In fact, its decision paper noted that Prudential did not use short-term funding. Without either unusual leverage or major short-term funding, it is highly unlikely that the policymakers, that the policyholders of Prudential would run in the event of a financial downturn, even a severe one. The word significant, which appeared in many of the paragraphs I just read to you, is used 47 times in the 12-page decision that was the paper that the FSOC devised for explaining what it had done. Mostly, they were used to describe the effect that a Prudential failure might have on the markets and on counterparties. But the FSOC made no effort to support its characterizations with the kind of numerical data that would give the word significant some meaning. The only useful numbers, in fact, in the agency's paper are the page numbers. The question of the exposure channel, if we get into that, is whether Prudential's failure would have an adverse effect on the rest of the market because of Prudential's interconnections with others. As in its discussion of the liquidation channel, the FSOC simply says that Prudential's interconnections are significant, but does not define what that means either for Prudential or its counterparties. Without that, it is impossible to determine what FSOC considered significant or sufficient to cause financial instability in the market as a whole, which, as you recall, is the statutory standard. In any event, the interconnectedness idea is invalid as a basis for designating a firm as a SIFI, and this is a really important point because it goes to the heart of the Dodd-Frank Act. It posits this idea of interconnectedness that when a large financial institution fails, its interconnections with others will have knock-on effects, causing others to weaken or fail. The notion that interconnectedness among large financial institutions is a source of danger to the financial system is at the heart of the Dodd-Frank Act. The reason for designating certain bank and non-bank financial firms as SIFIs and subjecting them to stringent regulation by the Fed was to prevent them from failing and then supposedly dragging down others and causing a financial crisis. But we know from the Lehman bankruptcy that interconnectedness was not a factor in the financial crisis. Lehman's failure, to be sure, caused chaos in the financial markets, but no major or indeed even minor financial institution failed as a result. This was true even though Lehman was one of the largest financial firms in the United States and was active in the credit default swap market, and the financial markets were in the midst of an unprecedented panic so great that banks were refusing to lend to one another even overnight. The only serious knock-on effect of the Lehman bankruptcy was the inability of a single money market fund called the Reserve Primary Fund to maintain the value of its shares at $1 a share. The fund had continued to hold Lehman commercial paper, probably expecting Lehman, like Bear Stearns, would be bailed out by the government, and its potential losses in the bankruptcy were great enough to cause its net asset value to fall to less than $1 if the Lehman paper was uncollectible. This is known as breaking the buck. In the midst of a panicky market, this produced what has been called a run on the fund. But in the end, the losses to the reserve fund shareholders were minimal, about 1 or 2%. Whatever might be said about the reserve funds breaking the buck, it was not akin to a firm being dragged into bankruptcy by the failure of a counterparty. It is simply a firm encountering an unexpected 1 to 2% loss. It is also occasionally argued that AIG is an example of the dangers of interconnectedness, but this idea also fails after serious examination. First, AIG had virtually no exposure to Lehman. In addition, despite a lot of speculation in the media about the Fed's reasons for rescuing AIG 2 days after Lehman failed, the officials involved at the Treasury and the Fed never said anything other than that they stepped in to rescue AIG because it was so large that its bankruptcy in the midst of the post-Lehman panic would have caused a complete meltdown of the financial system. It is not then a case of interconnectedness, but of the Treasury and Fed's view of market psychology at a time of particular market turmoil. Although interconnectedness had no role in the financial crisis, the idea is catnip for regulators because it provides a basis for more comprehensive regulation of individual financial institutions, something they arguably know how to do. The old line comes to mind, actually, if your only tool is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Thus, the Dodd-Frank Act assumes that by stringently regulating large financial institutions such as Prudential, these institutions can be kept from failing and bringing down other firms with which they are interconnected. The FSOC's use of the interconnectedness idea in its Prudential decision could have been barely persuasive, at least in theory, if the FSOC had shown that Prudential's counterparties and creditors had unusually large exposures to Prudential. But the FSOC didn't even attempt to demonstrate this. There should really be no surprise that the FSOC found that Prudential was a SIFI. 2 months earlier, the Financial Stability Board, that's the FSB I had mentioned before, had designated the U.S. insurers AIG, Prudential, and MetLife as SIFIs. The FSB is an international group of central banks, government ministers, and financial regulators. In 2008, shortly after the financial crisis, the G20 leaders directed the FSB to reform the international financial system so that a financial crisis would not occur. Since then, the FSB has been aggressive in designating SIFIs among banks and insurers, and it is beginning a program of doing the same in the securities and capital markets industry, which is what the FSB calls shadow banking. Both the Treasury and the Fed are members of the FSB, and by the way, they are the most influential members of the FSB, and thus they had already approved the designating Prudential as a SIFI before the FSOC actually took action. The FSB's test for SIFIs is whether they are institutions of such size, market importance, and global interconnectedness, that word again, that their distress or failure would cause significant dislocation in the global financial system and adverse economic consequences along a range of countries. This language is not materially different from the FSOC's, from the Dodd-Frank's reference to instability in the U.S. financial system. So FSB designations should involve roughly the same judgments about what factors will constitute an insurer as a SIFI. There was no substantial chance, accordingly, that Prudential would not be designated as a SIFI. The same, of course, is true of MetLife, which has not yet been designated by the FSOC, but has been designated by the FSB. The outcome of the FSOC's process is therefore a foregone conclusion and not the result of any serious analysis. For this reason, no doubt, every member of the FSOC who had any expertise in insurance, and here I am including the one person who was appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate because he was an expert in insurance, they all dissented from the FSOC's decision. The lack of serious analysis by the FSOC might not be much of an issue if the FSB itself had done a thorough and credible analysis of why Prudential should be classified as a SIFI. But no such analysis was done. The FSB purported to base its decision on a methodology developed by the International Association of Insurance Supervisors, but there was no indication when they made their announcement about the insurance firms that they were going to regard as SIFIs. There were nine of them, including, again, Prudential, MetLife, and AIG. There was no indication that they actually used that methodology. In other words, they were just as opaque, just as unable to describe or provide a reason for what they did as the FSOC was. The financial crisis has in many ways changed the rules that formerly confined financial regulators to a limited range of powers. Bank-like regulation, which includes supervisory control of risk-taking and minimum capital requirements, was previously approved for federal regulators only where government support, such as deposit insurance, threatened to create moral hazard. However, the narrative that came out of the 2008 financial crisis was that any large financial institution could cause another financial crisis if it failed. That's the old interconnectedness idea again. This provided the authority for the FSOC and the FSB to adopt prudential regulatory standards for the largest financial institutions, not just banks, because any one of them could, under the prevailing theory, cause a financial crisis if not stringently regulated or given bank-like regulation. For this reason, the FSOC, as empowered by the Dodd-Frank Act, and the FSB, empowered by the G20, were given a quasi-judicial authority to make decisions about specific institutions, not just general rules. FSB, indeed, as mentioned earlier, has already outlined an aggressive program that could eventually result in the designation of SIFIs in many other fields, including, as they have mentioned, securities firms, finance companies, mutual funds, hedge funds, in other words, any firm that operates in the capital markets. When those designations occur, it looks as though the firms so designated will be required by the Dodd-Frank Act to have bank-like capital requirements, as well as face stress tests and liquidity coverage ratios that the bank regulators have prescribed for banks under the Basel standards. All of the participants in this process, the G20 leaders, who authorized the FSB, the FSB, the FSOC, and the Fed, are government or regulatory organizations. There are many incentives for the FSB and the FSOC to be expansive in its range of coverage and few reasons for it to exercise restraint. They have an interest in increasing regulation of the largest financial institutions, not just because the conventional narrative is that these institutions could cause the next financial crisis, but more importantly, because regulators always want more power, just as companies always want more market share or profits. The narrative about the financial crisis has given the regulators an unprecedented opportunity to extend their power, and they are not likely to waste it. This is a key point that must be borne in mind by those representing institutions that are under threat of designation as SIFIs. The FSB's decision on the nine large insurers and the FSOC's prudential decision were not made on the basis of facts. Neither agency has articulated any standard for determining when a firm should be designated as a SIFI, and their discretion, therefore, is essentially unbounded. And of course, the FSB operates entirely outside the U.S. judicial system. Given the incentives of regulators, the prospect of vastly enlarging regulatory control, it is very doubtful that either of these agencies will be responsive to factual presentations in the future. No matter how persuasive and data-based these arguments, they will be ignored. This is not a true fact-finding exercise. It is a necessary procedural step in a process the purpose of which is to extend the power of financial regulators in every developed country, including the U.S. And I'll close with this. This suggests that the only way to slow or stop this train will be through Congress. It does not necessarily mean amending Dodd-Frank. That's, we know, would be very tough, especially in this administration and where the Senate is still controlled by the Democrats. A resolution of the House, however, or a joint letter by a large number of lawmakers in the House and Senate might be enough to stop or significantly slow the progress of this set of procedures that the FSB and the FSOC have adopted. But the prudential decision tells us that spending time making presentations to the FSOC will not be productive. Thanks very much.
Well, Peter, Wayne Abernathy here. Peter, I think it's fair to say that that's a fairly provocative statement you've just made, a pretty provocative argument because it goes to the core of much of what the structure of the Dodd-Frank Act is built upon. And what you're focusing on here, I see two particular problems. I would like you to maybe elaborate on them a little bit. One is you're talking to some degree about the very wisdom of these SIFI designations. And the second, I think this is where you spend most of your time, at least in the presentation this afternoon, on the process and particularly the accountability and the lack of accountability and the opportunities for abuse that brings up. Would you say a little bit more about those?
Yeah. First, let me just turn to the process because there is, as you know, Wayne, where you are at the American Bankers Association, you know that the way bank regulation, or at least bank capital regulation, has proceeded over the years is for an international body of regulators to make a decision about Basel I, Basel II, Basel III, how those things would operate, and then it is assumed that once that decision is made, the bank regulators and all the countries that participated in this would all join in adopting the same or at least something very close to what decision was made in Basel. And what worries me about the process that we're looking at here is that this FSB, the Financial Stability Board in Europe, made up of regulators and finance ministers and governments and central banks, will decide who the SIFIs should be, as they have already done with banks and now with insurance companies, and soon decide that it will be that the SIFIs will also include all operators or many of the larger operators in the capital markets, the securities firms, mutual funds, asset managers of various kinds, hedge funds. Those will all be regarded as SIFIs, or at least the largest ones will. And once that has happened, it will be assumed that the Fed, which under the Dodd-Frank Act is given authority to regulate these SIFIs, would then pick up the regulation of all these organizations and proceed with turning them effectively into organizations that are regulated by banks. In other words, they would be far less innovative. They would have much more capital. They would be constrained to reduce their risk-taking, all of the kinds of things that bank regulators just love to do when they get hold of a bank. They would now do it for capital markets players, which they have called shadow banks. So the process in that sense, Wayne, worries me a lot. Now, the SIFI designation itself is, in my view, illegitimate, invalid, and based on the wrong idea. Congress somehow got the idea, and I no doubt it came from the regulators themselves, that the financial crisis was caused by these interconnections between large financial institutions. But if you look at what happened in the financial crisis, it's nothing like that. In fact, we have a test, as I suggested in this statement I made. We have a test in the form of Lehman. Lehman was over a $600 billion firm. It was one of the largest financial institutions in the world. It suddenly went into bankruptcy. Now, that would have been the kind of case where if interconnectedness was really a problem, if Lehman was going to drag other large financial institutions down, that would have been the case where it did. However, it didn't. No financial institution failed as a result of Lehman. The one case that we can point to, as I did, was this money market fund called the Reserve Primary Fund. But that lost 1% to 2%. Truly, it broke the buck, but that's not bankruptcy. That's just losing 1% to 2% and not being able to redeem your shares at $1 a share. So we don't have a case for interconnectedness, and yet interconnectedness is what the Dodd-Frank Act is based on.
Well, I think there is generally in this town and probably throughout some of the other financial capitals of the world, at least among the regulators, the view that the failure of one of these significant firms like Samson can bring down the whole temple on everybody inside. And I think you've made a case of really asking the question, show me where that has happened. And pretty hard to find an example. Let me ask it the other way, though. I want to poke at this a little bit. If maybe there's a justification for these SIFI designations, not in the failure of an institution, but how about in the success of an institution? The idea being that the success of an institution can be so powerful and influential on a financial system, and I have in mind Fannie and Freddie, that it can introduce unacceptable risk into the financial system, distorting the whole markets and distorting the financial system. And maybe there's a risk there that the FSOC ought to be looking at.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. And if I really thought the FSOC was a legitimate inquiry into the question of whether these large financial institutions were dangerous, they might consider that point. But that isn't their objective. And as I said, I have made a provocative statement here because I believe that the regulators in this case, not only in the United States but around the world, see an opportunity here that they have never had before. And that is an opportunity to take control of much of the financial system. You know, the regulators say that the organizations that are in the capital markets, like mutual funds and asset managers and securities firms, they are all engaged in what the bank regulators call regulatory arbitrage, because from their point of view, everyone who is outside the bank regulatory structure is in regulatory arbitrage. They're avoiding regulation. But in fact, these are the entities, and this is very clear in the data, in the Fed's flow of funds data. It's very clear that almost, I'd say about 80% or 85% of all of the financing of American business and state and local governments is done through the capital markets, through bonds, notes, commercial paper, than is done by banks. So if we actually allowed the regulators to get control of the so-called shadow banks, which is the capital markets operators, we would have a much different economy, one that operated much more slowly and in which growth would be impeded substantially.
Let me ask one other question, and then I think we can open up the lines for questions from the callers. This is now getting, again, at this question of accountability and so forth. Given the tie between the FSOC and the FSB, and frankly, we see this elsewhere in where you have our regulatory agencies go abroad and engage in these international discussions with their colleagues from other nations and then come back with a formula and say, well, we got to do it, and we've got to impose it here. We saw that, for example, at Basel with the negotiation of the Basel III Capital Accord, not a treaty, not any kind of governmental mandate, at least from Congress. The regulators went abroad, came back with a structure and said, all right, we're going to impose this on everybody because we agreed to it. Well, there never was any kind of accountability to it. They came up with their ideas, and it didn't fit very well here. And I think you're making the case that is very much what we're seeing with FSOC and the FSB. Given that kind of connection of international agreement, regulators bring it back and say, well, we got to do it because we've agreed to it. How do we get more transparency and accountability into the activities of not only FSOC, but the FSB and some of these other international bodies?
Well, that's really a very good question, because it's at the moment, it's impenetrable. Both the FSOC activities, their debates internally, are not transparent. No one else is allowed to go there. In fact, interestingly, in the FSOC, which is made up of the leaders of the heads of the 10 major financial regulators in the United States, not other members of the agencies of which these people are the heads are allowed to go to FSOC meetings. So, for example, the other four commissioners at the SEC can't attend the FSOC meetings, only the chairman can. So that's completely untransparent. And then the FSB is exactly the same. No one can go. In fact, for a long time, they didn't even notify people where their meetings were going to be held. So one of the things we can do to make them more accountable, to make them more transparent, so to speak, is for Congress to insist that it have an opportunity to see what is going on in the FSB's meetings. If the FSB is going to be so important, they'd like to know who is making these decisions and on the basis of what facts the decisions are being made. Because this has enormous trade as well as regulatory consequences. We can seriously weaken our economy if we allow the way the FSB, the way the Europeans in particular, look at a financial system and allow that financial system structure, which is very bank heavy, to influence our particular structure, which is far more open and available to different kinds of financial organizations, and accounts, in my view, for the success of the U.S. economy.
I note that Congressman Garrett has introduced a bill with regard to negotiations that the Federal Reserve engages in internationally, and one of the provisions of the bill is the Federal Reserve can't agree to anything until they have first exposed it for, I think it's 60 or 90 days for public comment.
Yeah, absolutely. A very, very good idea. And at least certainly one of the ways to do this. But it is important for Congress really to understand that they have an enormous stake in this.
Yeah.
And what worries me is that they might be looking at this as, well, this is just another Basel. This is just another Basel thing. And so we've never interfered in what the bank regulators did in Basel. So isn't this the same thing? No, it is not the same thing. It's a much, much bigger deal.
And very intrusive. With that, are we ready to open the line up for calls from the floor?
Yeah, let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we're all going to hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our experts today, push the star button and then the pound button. We've got about 20 minutes left. It looks like, Wayne, we've got two questions. So with that, let's go to our first caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Let's focus for a minute on solutions. I think it's clear to most of the participants in this forum that the Dodd-Frank approach is incompetent, that it is at best ineffective and likely to be counterproductive. But that the underlying problem is that no one really understands the financial sector as a whole. Our best and brightest young mathematicians get scarfed up out of the universities to go to work to find ways to make money for their employers. But no one seems to be trying to develop a comprehensive system of models, and I say system because it's going to take more than one, to enable policymakers to really get a handle on what is going on in this vast financial market that we have created for ourselves. And as for Lehman being an indicator, I think we should be kept in mind that it did not collapse in isolation. There were a lot of other things going on at the time, including a huge confusion of fiat currency into a market which one may debate the substantive effects of inflating the market, But the psychological effects were perhaps more important. And it was the psychological effect of Lehman which may have been more important than contractual connections. So how would we address the management of this entire system? And if it is not manageable, perhaps we ought to find ways to make it manageable by simply breaking everything up that we can, or perhaps even going to a Schmitta system where we just shut down all credit institutions, everything that deals in credit instruments, shut it down every 7 years, 1 year, and just reset the whole world economy.
Well, let's pause there. Peter, what do you think about those points that are raised?
Well, I'm happy the points were raised as they were, because it gives me an opportunity to talk about something that you don't often get to when you talk about what happened in the financial crisis. We've been talking about, I was mentioning Lehman and the effect, the lack of effect of Lehman's failure. But what you have to really go back to is what caused the financial crisis. Because we haven't had a financial crisis like this in 100 years. The last one was probably the panic of 1907. The what happened in the Depression looked like a financial crisis, but it wasn't the same thing. It was actually unemployment problems involving the economy as a whole. The financial crisis wasn't, the financial sector was not particularly involved in that. But what caused the financial crisis in the United States? And that, in my view, is housing policies of the United States, which reduced underwriting standards in the housing market. And the result of that was that all these large financial institutions and a lot of small ones ended up holding mortgages or mortgage-backed securities that were very, very weak by 2007 and 2008. Now, the question you're really asking is, well, why did all of these institutions have the same junky mortgages? And the answer to that is that a lot of it came from regulation, and particularly in the banking area. All the banks were given incentives to buy mortgage-backed securities by the Basel regulations. If there hadn't been any Basel regulations telling them what the cost, the capital cost of mortgage-backed securities was in relation to the capital cost of an ordinary corporate bond, they might have had much more diversified portfolios. But the capital costs of mortgage-backed securities were so low because of the Basel regulations that almost all banks bought them. And that is one of the reasons why, when market values fell so drastically, when the great housing bubble declined, we had the weakness in all banks at the same time, and really all financial institutions at the same time. And the ones that were actually specialized in that area, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, collapsed completely and became insolvent and had to be taken over by the government. So the point here is, we don't need the government to understand and control the entire financial system. What we need is the government to leave the financial system alone and allow the financial system to do what it can do so well, and that is to innovate, diversify, look for places where profit can be made, and close down things where profit cannot be made. All of those things are the functions of the financial system without regulation. And if you bring in a lot of regulation, as the regulators want to do, you simply distort the way the system operates.
I think you're making a point, Peter, that the way the Basel capital rules are operating is really a form of credit allocation.
Absolutely, absolutely. And now, actually, yes, and worse than that, Wayne, some of the stuff that is coming out of the Fed and the other bank regulators is directly credit allocation now. They are actually telling the banks, we don't want you to make, for example, any more leveraged loans, because we think that there's a bubble developing in the leveraged loan market. And so they are actually saying that you're not to make certain kinds of loans, and that is not very far from saying now you have to make certain kinds of loans because we don't think that a sufficient amount of credit has been made available to various sectors of the economy. And when you think about it, what was the government's housing policy? It was credit allocation to mortgages. And that's what got us into trouble.
Let's have another call, Dean.
Okay, we've got one caller on the line at this point. If you have a question, you need to push the star button and the pound button on your telephone to join the queue. Looks like we've got two callers now. Let's go to our next question.
Go ahead, caller.
Thank you. This is Jack Park. Thank you, Peter. I have a little riff off John's John Rowland's question about workability. And do we have any confidence that after designating SIFIs, the problem won't arise? We won't blindside us from a non-SIFI. And here I'm thinking of long-term capital in 1998, I think it was, which would never have made which would likely not have made the SIFI designation.
Yeah, I think, Jack, you're completely right. And in fact, we don't need SIFIs, even under the Dodd-Frank Act, if we are worried about the failure of large financial institutions. Now, I don't happen to be a fan of the so-called orderly liquidation authority in Title II of Dodd-Frank, which gives a lot of power to the FDIC. But the Secretary of the Treasury, under the Dodd-Frank Act, has the authority to basically take over any financial firm that he believes might cause financial instability in the U.S. market if it becomes distressed. Take it over and hand it over for liquidation by the FDIC. So whether you're a SIFI or not is not important if you look at Title II. All you have to be is a firm that might cause instability in the market. So if you think that we need something like that, and I'm not sure I do think so. We certainly don't need we don't need the designation of SIFIs in order to get there, and it's counterproductive in another sense, because when we designate SIFIs, we are essentially saying they are too big to fail. And if we tell the market that these companies are too big to fail, that will reduce the costs. Their costs of credit, because many lenders will at that point say, I'm going to be safer if I lend to one of these too big to fail firms than if I lend to some smaller firm that hasn't been so designated. And so we are building within each of the markets, the insurance market, the capital markets, the securities market, the basis for the too big to fail problem that now afflicts our banking system.
What's the definition of financial instability or market instability that extends this great power to the regulators?
No, there's no definition, and that's one of the problems. That's why they can define their own jurisdiction, unlike any regulatory agency ever established. They can decide what financial distress means and what market instability means. Who knows?
Yeah. Amazing arbitrary authority. Do we have another caller, Dean?
We do. We have one question pending at this point. If you have a question, we've still got some time left. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Go ahead, caller.
Peter, Wayne, this is Mark Brickle with a question. You've identified, Pete, I'll just pick up on your last point, a potential financial benefit for firms that are designated as systemically important. And if the firms are aware of that benefit, they might become ambivalent or even seek the designation. To what extent was that a factor in the decisions about the insurance industry? Did these firms work hard to keep from being designated as systemically important or not?
Wonderful question. Actually, one of the insurance firms, AIG, actually asked or delighted in the fact that it was going to be declared financially a SIFI. And that was because it's the head of that organization, Ben Moshe, said that it was this a seal of government approval, and it would help a lot in competing with other firms. And I think he was absolutely right. If you imagine an insurance company's salesman going into a corporation or any other kind of potential customer, sitting down with him and saying, look, let me tell you, our firm has been designated as a SIFI. We are too big to fail, according to the government. If we fail, we'll bring down the whole damn thing. So you would be very safe if you lodged your business with us, because it's highly unlikely that the government would actually allow us to fail to meet all our financial obligations for obvious reasons. So at least in the insurance industry, one person has recognized that, and that was this Ben Moshe, who's head of the AIG. Prudential thought about fighting it and decided not to, for the reasons I think I suggested before. They didn't want to get into crosswise with their regulator. And then MetLife is still not designated yet. It's been designated by the FSB, but not by the FSOC. And MetLife is still pondering whether they should or could legally challenge that designation.
I would note that the mutual fund industry is fighting like cats and dogs to keep out of that designation. They apparently don't see it as a benefit. What would you say to that?
Yeah, I think, first of all, it's absurd to think that mutual funds could be systemically important, because what happens if a mutual fund loses money is really simple. All its shareholders lose money. In other words, those losses are transmitted immediately to an enormous number of individual people and pension funds and others, just like when the market falls. All those companies lose some money. But leaving that apart, the whole idea of designation as a SIFI is attractive in some ways, but on the other hand, you're no longer running your company. You have no idea the kind of regulations that you'll be put under, likely to make you much less profitable because they'll be very costly in terms of capital and so forth. But more important, I think, to most of the people who run these companies is you're no longer in charge. The regulators will be in charge, the Fed will be in charge, and they will tell you how to run the company. And most people don't care to be in a situation like that. They would prefer to have the ability to make the policies for their company and not to have the government tell them what to do.
Is it more or less the question is put to you, to your firm, do you want to be a utility or do you want to be a more free market actor? Some will choose one, some will choose the other.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. My sense is that apart from this feeling on the part of CEOs and others that they should be able to run their own companies and not have the government tell them how to run the companies, I think the likelihood is that if they are designated as SIFIs, they will have benefits that will far outweigh the additional costs. But think about this. Think about it this way. No matter what is the actual outcome, it's going to be bad for the rest of us either way. Because if the additional costs are greater than the benefits, then these firms are going to gradually be outcompeted by their more nimble and less regulated competitors. And if, on the other hand, the benefits outweigh the costs, then these firms will end up being the same way the very largest banks are, and that is dominant in their industries. No one can challenge them, and the industries themselves will consolidate into a few very large institutions over time. So in either case, it's terrible. The only way it actually works is if the additional cost of being a SIFI is exactly balanced by the benefits of being a SIFI, and the likelihood of that happening is minimal.
Yeah, pretty small. Dean, do we have time for another call?
We don't have any questions pending. Let me make a last call for questions. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone if you want to see the final question of the day. Otherwise, I don't see any at this point, Wayne. I don't know if you have a final question.
I do. I have one idea that really has been one that bugs me as I watch the way the FSOC operates. And it's so boring that not even C-SPAN's willing to cover it. But what I noticed is I wonder if the FSOC, being this group of regulators, the heads of these regulations, 15 of them when everybody's put together, is there a risk of groupthink developing at the FSOC so that rather than identifying, the whole theory of the FSOC is they're going to identify systemic risks as they arise that others might have otherwise missed. With that groupthink, is there rather the risk that instead of identifying these gaps, there's going to be a sentiment of, well, let's all work together and not rock the boat, and there'll be a reluctance, actually, to call out an agency for missing something. I don't see the FSOC, for example, ever raising the question about the systemic risks involved with the Fed's prolonged 0 to 25 basis point interest rate policy.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. They don't have the authority to deal with interest rate policy, but there is a refinement here that I didn't mention, but it's worth mentioning. And that is that the FSOC is made up of the heads, the chairs of all of these regulatory bodies. And that means they have all been appointed by the administration in power and confirmed by the Senate in most cases. So they are actually all of a single mind as individuals. They are not supposed to be representing their agencies. They are supposed to be representing themselves. This is extremely important. And so, since they're all appointed by the president, the Secretary of the Treasury is the person they look to decide these questions for them, because he speaks within the councils of the FSOC for the administration in authority. So groupthink is a modest way to describe what we really have here. We actually have a herd that is well controlled.
Any last words, Peter, before we conclude our call?
No, I do thank Federalist Society for an opportunity to do this, and I hope that the people who are listening in will take to heart the points I made. This is a very, very serious problem, and we have to find a way to stop this train.
Well, I, for one, want to thank you not only for writing the paper, but taking the time to speak with us today and share the highlights with us and to field some of the questions. Back to you, Dean.
Thank you. Good questions.
Thank you. This is Dean Reuter. Let me thank you both, Peter Wallison and Wayne Abernathy, and remind our audience that the paper we've been talking about here today is available on the Federalist Society's website. It is the authority of the FSOC and the FSB to designate SIFIs. In addition to being on our website, it's posted on Networks Financial Institute at Indiana State University on their website. And I will say on Peter's behalf, it is a very, very important paper, a very important issue. Thank you all for joining us today, and thank you for your questions. Please check the Federal Society's website as well for upcoming Teleforum conference calls. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.